Hello, everybody. We have one sole sponsor this week. That's right. It's a complete takeover. And we can thank the folks at Random House for that. They want me to tell you all about Keith Rawson's new novel, The Devil by Name. And you know what? They're coming with some receipts. Stephen King himself called The Devil by Name an exciting, suspenseful, and horrifying novel. And Publishers Weekly calls it literary horror at its finest. Don't miss the heart-stopping follow-up to The Fever House about a post-apocalyptic America, one in which survivors are united by the desire to not just escape death, but to carve out a way to live anew. The Devil by Name is available from Random House and can be found wherever books are sold. No one expected the apocalypse would be broadcast by telephone, but in Keith Rawson's The Devil by Name, the follow-up to a smash hit The Fever House, anyone who managed to survive that doomsday call has a harrowing answer to the question, where were you when the message came through? A heart-stopping saga set against the ravaged landscape of a post-apocalyptic America, The Devil by Name is available now from Random House and can be found wherever books are sold. And that just leaves Fangoria. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. The magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. I have an article in this new issue that is just going to print. I think you guys will like it. It might be a little sad, but it's how I've been using the work of Stephen King to help kind of get me through Scott's passing. So it's a little bit of a personal essay that has a little tinge of Stephen Kinginess to it. So I think you guys will like it. But you know what? I can guarantee you it's well written. It's high quality writing, baby. And that will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online. So if you want to join in on the fun, well, you'll need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And use the code KINGCAST at checkout if you do, because you will get a whopping 25% off of your order at Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes death is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
And I'm Winter Mitchell-Rorba.
And we are your hosts. Y'all know Winter by now. She's a writer, strategist to the stars, a chaos agent in human form, and a podcast host whose current show is Tangent Island. That's correct, right, Winter?
No.
I'm not fucking that up already?
You're not. No? I haven't recorded an episode in weeks since Wampler died.
That's Scott's fault. That's not your fault.
It is Scott's fault. So it's Scott's
I don't.
Fault,
I didn't even know that. That forever. But I'm just blaming anything that goes wrong.
I'm
Scott
blaming
not being
him
here,
for that
so.
Too. It's hard. I don't. I'm waiting for the magic touch to return. So it's on hiatus.
Okay, but it's still. You know, you're co-hosting this show right now, so you're technically still a podcaster.
That's the most important thing. That's the most important thing is that I'm here today, right now.
Well, Winter is here filling in the guest co-host seat this week to help me interrogate our guests. Yes, this is an interrogation, and it's too late to back out now, my dude. I got you, fucker. The topic is a favorite one here at the KingCast, and that's Stephen King's most underappreciated and overlooked novel, 2014's Revival. And our guest is a writer and director whose latest film, Strange Darling, starring Willa Fitzgerald and Kyle Gallner, is out in theaters right now. It's rad. Everybody go watch it. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome JT Molnar to the KingCast.
Yay.
Hi. Yay.
Great to be here. Hi, Winsor. Hi, Eric.
This is wonderful.
This is wonderful.
It's wonderful to be here. And yeah, I can't get in on the Scott insults because I didn't know him. But I
tried to get you to know him.
I really wish I did. It's a great, big regret. And I've heard just the most amazing things. And I'm so sorry.
Well, let the magic image of what Wampler could have been and should have been be the angel in your mind.
Beautiful.
The good thing about Scott is he puts so much of his authentic self out there. So
yeah,
you know, I've told this to a few people who kind of only knew of him through Twitter or the show. But it's true. That was him. I mean, that's just that dude. Maybe with a 90, with the filter off like 5% or on 5%, it's like 95% unadulterated Scott Wampler at all times in his tweets and his mentions. So
I had a feat, like I felt like I knew him just because of the interactions on social. And I'm sure everybody talks about that, but like I felt like I knew him because his personality was all over social media all the time. And even I think like at some point we followed each other, and then I literally thought I knew him, and I thought from some scenario, and then I ended up being turned on to your show. And so when I heard the news, I mean, it was deeply affecting to so many people, even people who weren't personally acquainted.
Yeah.
Sucks, but it's good to be here with the two of you today. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And I'm excited to talk to you about your movie. I'm excited to talk to you about Revival. But you know, there's the kind of elephant in the room that I didn't mention in your intro but I want to just tear the band-aid off.
Oh, the interrogation.
I left off a big, big, big King connection in your intro, and I'm just going to ask you a couple of questions about it before we dive into the meat of this thing, if you don't mind. So you wrote the screenplay for The Long Walk. You're not the first to adapt this, by the way, but your script is the first one to actually make it in front of cameras. So one, congratulations on that. Fucking, you did something Frank Darabont couldn't do. and you got your adaptation actually filming. I know you can't talk much about specifics, but I'm curious how you ended up attached to the movie.
Yeah. And God, I love Frank Darabont. I wish he would make another movie. So yeah, it's miraculous. I mean, I don't know how I think a lot of it had to do with luck. A lot of it had to do with a guy named Roy Lee, who is, you know, the one of the greatest producers, there is, and really a Stephen King lover. And I just think it was a timing thing. And obviously I think we, you know, did a good job with the script, working with Francis Lawrence on it. But I don't know how, you know, Romero and Darabont and all these amazing guys who have much more talent than I do happen to, it didn't happen. And I guess, you know, in LA, that's just what happens with movies. There's timing and luck and all these different things involved. But with this, it was great. I was just finishing post on Strange Darling, and it had been a really long, arduous process. We shot the movie for a year, and then we're in post for almost a year because there was a lot of back and forth with the studio and test screenings before I got to lock my cut. And right when we were finished with that, I was just so emotionally drained and creatively exhausted. Because there's nothing in the world I love more than writing and directing a movie. But after it's done, in order to recharge and be able to direct another movie, I need a down period.
Right.
Know? But I still needed to keep working. And so Roy Lee called me, and he knows I'm a, you know, constant reader, and that I'm not incredibly excited about adapting books because I have a lot of my own ideas. But he knows that the books I'd like to adapt, the exceptions are definitely Stephen King books and, of course, Caroline Kepnes books, which that's a whole nother story. But with Stephen King, Roy called me, and he had been the producer on Strange Darling, one of them. Him and Steven Schneider were our main producers with my partner, Chris Ivancevic, and Bill Block, and Giovanni Ribisi. But Roy was the guy who got that movie made. And he called me up when we were finished it with post, and he said, I've got the rights to The Long Walk, and I'm not looking for a director. I have a director in mind who I'm talking to, and it's Francis Lawrence. But we definitely need somebody to write it. And I said, I would love that job. And so he told me that before, you know, the movie wasn't set up with a studio at the time. It was just Roy and the movie and a director who he was talking to, Francis. And so he called me, he said, well, let me make sure Francis is going to do it. And if he's going to do it, then we can try and get you on it. And so a few weeks after that, he called me and said, Francis is on. He'd like to meet with you. And so I went over to Francis's office in Hollywood, and we sat down and talked about the book. And he had such a love for this book, a reverence for it, that we just connected on it. I mean, it's his favorite Stephen King book. And the book had a, you know, an incredible impact on me growing up as well. And he was just so excited about making it. I knew it was in the right hands, and he was telling me the type of book he was going to do and, or the type of movie he was going to make and how it was going to be rated R, and you know, it just sounded great. Right. And so, so I pitched him, you know, me as a writer. And I just said, you know, we want to be faithful to the book. So let's do it.
What if there are werewolves in it now?
That was the pitch. It was actually vampires that I pitched. But, I didn't pitch an idea because we both knew we loved the book. I basically just, he'd read my script for Strange Darling and maybe another writing sample and knew he thought my writing was a good fit. And I think he just wanted to see whether we got along, quite honestly. Right. And so we had a really good talk. And then like the next day, Roy said, he wants you to write it. And then, we took it to Lionsgate, and Francis and I, and Roy were all three on a Zoom with Lionsgate, and Francis pitched them, you know, his approach. And then they told us they were making the movie. And so, so I went into the writing process and worked, for, you know, a good amount of months, after the first draft, or I sent a draft to Francis, and then the two of us kind of, you know, worked on it together, to get that first studio submission and sent it in, and they said they loved it and they wanted to go make the movie. So it all happened really fast, and it's been very, very exciting.
Now, that's wonderful. That's awesome to hear. You know, my biggest fear, just, you know, from somebody a million miles away from the project, was that this was a thing where it's like, well, Francis Lawrence did The Hunger Games and he was just like, this is kind of in my wheelhouse. I guess I'll do this thing. So to hear him going like, no, this is like my favorite King novel and one I've been obsessed with, you know, since my, you know, high school years or whatever, that actually does a lot to kind of calm some of my nerves, because this is one of my all time favorite King stories as well. I think I've said on the show before, it's his first masterpiece. And I stand by that. It's not maybe the first masterpiece to release, but it's the first one he wrote, because he wrote this motherfucker while he's in college, and all the other stuff he was writing around that time. You get stuff like Blaze and, you know, stuff that doesn't hit as hard, or some of the other Bachman books. But there's something about The Long Walk that, like, it grabs you from the fucking first moment you meet Garrity, and doesn't let you go until the end. And the characterization is so rich. I can only imagine it was either a dream or a nightmare to adapt. I don't think that there's going to be much middle road there. It's either you're going to be pulling your hair out, hoping you get it right the whole time, or it's just already there and you just get to act as a conduit for it. So
I was terrified, you know, the whole time. And, just because I respect and admire Stephen King so much, and I deeply love that book, and I respect and admire Francis so much. Yeah. So it was one of these things where I just wanted to do right by all of them. And we just went in a direction that I'm very, very happy with. And incredibly excited about it. And I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure if you had those fears about his, reasoning for doing it or something like that, yeah, that it couldn't be further from the truth. It's all about the passion, and, such a great director. And I know this is a labor of love for him, this movie.
Well, great. Well, that's all. I won't bug you for any more stuff. I'm not trying to get any scoops. I just want a peace of mind. That's all I wanted. So,
yeah.
You did a good job, Esty.
Phenomenal. Oh, good.
Yeah.
But do tell me something that's going to get aggregated, because we need to pump up the numbers a little bit on the show. So, so you can say, you know, I don't know, Mark Hamill is de-aged and will be the main, will be playing Garrity. I mean, anything you want to say in there. No, I won't make you do that.
That's fantastic.
But he's a
very nice guy, by the way.
Oh, man. My interactions with Mark Hamill over the years have been very small, but they've been very memorable. So I hold that guy to high esteem. Like, I'll tell you one real quick story before we move on. There was a 30th anniversary, I think, screening of Return of the Jedi at the Egyptian, maybe, or the American Cinematheque, mm-hmm. theater, whichever one of those. if the, those might actually be the same one for all I fucking know. I'm not an LA guy. I went there and like a friend was putting it on. So it's like, hey, do you want to come like off into the wings? Well, you know, Mark Hamill's going to come do the Q&A at the end or whatever. Do you want to watch the Q&A? I said, yeah. And he's like, yeah, you can come hang out with us. And Mark Hamill was there and he was just like sitting around like watching the end of the movie or something. And then he just randomly turns to me and like the three random nerds that were behind him, never said word one to us before or us to him. And he just goes, you ever notice that all the good superheroes are played by non-Americans? And he's just like, Christian Bale's Batman, you know, he's British. He's like, and then they just cast this fucking Australian as, you know, blah, 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 like all this stuff. And he goes, I don't know, maybe we should get some Americans in there. And he just turns back around and looks at the thing like completely out of nowhere. And I'm like, you know what, Mark Hamill, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. Give some of these American actors
podcast a superhero. Is this? What?
Welcome to Ben Shapiro's The King Cast.
But
it wasn't like fuck weird. All those nerds stealing our jobs kind of things, but it was just like, you ever notice? And I was just like, that's noticed. Really funny.
We've noticed, Mark Hamill.
You ever notice that?
Oh my God.
We got it. We got it.
Judy Greer's in the movie too.
Yeah. And she's playing
her.
The general.
I love her.
He's amazing. The cast that's been assembled with, you know, Cooper and David Johnson and Judy Greer and all of them, they're just, I you know, you don't always get to go to set as a writer these days. A lot of times it's done remotely. And this was really old school. I got to go out there for the table reads and
that's awesome.
Leading up to it and the first bit of production it's just a really nice, it's just such a great group of people, cast member, everybody's really on board. So I think that'll translate because so much of the movie is about, or so much of the book, you know, is about the chemistry and connection between all those characters.
Yeah. Right. I love Judy. She came on the show once and she like, there were some times where you can tell Scott, like, either hit it off with the guest or didn't. Mm. I think Scott was low key in love with Judy Greer. Like at the end of this, I think if she had turned to him and like femme fatale style going like, hey, kill my husband. He would have been okay.
She is just like a sleeper. If you look back at everything that she's ever done and you kind of like retrospectively think about her filmography, you realize that she is in fact like the best part of the movie. It doesn't matter how many scenes she's in. She's like the best part of the movie. That's one thing about her. Older, looking back, you know what I mean? Like I look back and when she shows up and her name shows up in the title, I'm like, oh my God, Judy Greer. Just like I said just now, like she's fantastic.
She's the best.
She's so good. She's so good. And she's one of those, all of a sudden I'd be having conversations with her and I'd be like, oh my God, I forgot. Of course you were in The Descendants, but I just,
of course.
Think about it. And of course you were the reason I love The Descendants. Like there's so many movies like where you just kind of disappears into the role in such a way that not all actors can
do. She is the best part of The Descendants. She is. Mm. So good. Fully. So
Robert Forrest is pretty damn good too. But
he's very good, but she is to me, again, the sleeper. The sleeper.
Yep.
She comes in.
And I got a bit of a cold, guys, so if I'm clearing my throat, apologies to the audience listening.
All good.
I'm clearing it over you a few
they
times.
They can handle it.
Yes, I will be able to cut out the throat clearings where somebody else isn't talking during it. So I will do my best to ease the ears here. Winter, do you have a question you want to throw at JT
before we? Are we talking about The Long Walk still?
You can do.
I don't want
whatever
no,
you want.
No, because I don't want to. No, we're not. Oh, okay.
No, I guess you know.
Let's talk about the short walk.
The long walk. Okay. I can say like the nine thing. I think it's okay to say it was great experience.
No. Let's move on. I'm moving on. Moving on. Let's talk about Strange Darling. No.
Yes.
I know you love talking about it, and I want that for you, and I want the success of it for you. But let's talk about something else that I'm super obsessed with, and that's Strange Darling, because I think that it's really exciting to see a friend get what they want. I always said this. I said this to my girlfriend that I brought to the premiere. I love when my friends get what they want. Because it's rare, especially in this industry. This industry is a mess. And I have a lot of friends who are directors, and I have a lot of friends who are writers, and I have a lot of friends who are actresses and actors, and they don't get what they want. And I think that this is a project that allowed you to get what you want. So I would love for you to talk to, you know, the listeners about sort of your process in this, after this, you know, through this quickly, like what, where are you with it? How do you sit with it? I think
you have 30 seconds. Go.
You have 30 seconds. Go.
That's hilarious. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Winter. Thank you. That means a lot. It's been, you know, you know, I mean, I was directing short films when I met you years and years ago, you know, and I don't know. It's when I look back at, how long, you know, you come to LA or you go to New York or wherever you're working in the industry. Now it's sort of decentralized, but when you start working and you're a director or writer or whatever you do, an actor, and you have certain things you want to be working on and you're focused on them, years just go by sometimes. And sometimes there'll be, you know, it took 10 years for my short film career to become a feature film career. And when I finally made my first feature, Outlaws and Angels, we got into Sundance. I thought, oh, that's it. Cool. I'll be making a movie every 2 years. And not every year, but every 2 or 3 years at least. And so that movie did well at Sundance, and then it came out and nobody saw it. And half the people who saw it were repulsed by it. And so it did, you know, it opened doors for me. I got my agent. I was able to start making a living doing certain things, in our industry, but getting another movie off the ground was difficult. I was trying to make dramas. I was trying to make, and just movies outside of the box, and it really wasn't working out. And the weird thing is that I would have cast attached to a project, but no money. And then we'd have money, but no cast. And we got really, really close with a couple films. I was supposed to do a movie called Even Beautiful Things Must Die. And Roseanne Korenberg was producing it, and Clifton Collins Jr. and Heather Graham and Robert Forrester were the three leads. And we were, I was really excited about that film, and we were about to go shoot it. And then we lost Robert. Who had been a dear friend for a lot of years. And so that was a, you know, a gut punch. And by the time we came around and were in a place where we felt even ethically okay with recasting that role, like a year later, and we started setting a path forward, the pandemic hit. And right. So then we lost a couple of years there. Right. And so, so it doesn't feel like, a lot of people have asked me, why is there 8 years between your two movies? Well, we started shooting just under 6 years between the two films, and then now the movie's ready. But it was, you know, the pandemic happened and all this stuff happened. And I'm not the kind of person who can write, you know, if they call me and say, write The Long Walk, we want you to do this. I can adapt a book, I can do a job, and thank God this job is such a great job. But as far as coming up with ideas, if my agent says, write a horror movie or write a action movie or write something, because this type of movie is doing well in the market, it's not in my DNA to do that. I cannot do it. And so it has to be something I come up with organically that inspires me. And I'm never thinking about genre when I'm being inspired. And then I'll come up with an idea, and then I'll say, oh, I wonder what genre that is, and I'll write it. And so when Strange Darling came to me, it was all about this archetype, you know, this woman running through the woods in distress. And I had this image in my head, and that's how a lot of my ideas initially come to me. And there were other ideas I was thinking of at the same time, but I had this image in my head, and she was compelling, and I could hear this strangely. I mean, I love Emmylou Harris and Graham Parsons, but Love Hurts isn't my favorite song in the world. But for some reason, that song was playing over this cinematic thing I saw, and I could see the colors. And from then, over the course of a few months, as I was, you know, just doing mundane tasks, the rest of this story came to me. And I thought it was a nice, different way to approach the final girl and to give her more agency, and to also find a way to, I thought it became compelling to me because it was an interesting way to have a female lead in a role that I feel like would, in many cases, because of the damage and the issues that this character faces would usually be played by a male actor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, so I just, it started really getting in, and it started, it was the characters and a lot of the, you know, kind of things the movie said are very different than how I feel about things in life. So the whole thing, it was, it even sort of subverted my expectations when I was coming up with it. And I decided I'm going to write this thing. And so when I wrote it, it didn't, all of a sudden the people around me, my agent, my manager, you know, my wife, like all the people were like, oh, this is like, this might be something that, that a lot of people like mm-hmm. everybody sort of thought I wrote a pop song finally, like by accident. And my agent was excited and Giovanni Ribisi was excited when I sent it to him to read. And so the weirdest thing about this was I spent all these years in development on projects for a long time. And I'd have a big producer attached to a project of mine and say, we're going to get this made. And then a year would go by or 2 years would go by. And once I finished writing this, we were shooting it 6 months later. I mean, it was just nuts. So it's a dream, you know, it was a really, tough production process because, you know, you've seen the movie. It's, it doesn't look like a horror film. It's a very bright, colorful, we had this idea, Blood on the Flower Bed. We were looking at films like, you know, The Red Shoes and Blue Velvet and Dead Ringers and The Devils and movies that had this really inherent darkness underneath the surface, but looked beautiful and were candy coated. We wanted to have that contrast and use color as a weapon. And so when we were sending dailies back initially, the studio was like, what are you doing? Like, what is this? It looks like Pee-wee's Playhouse. Like, we don't understand. And so we had a tough time convincing people that it was, that the whole thing would work. But in the end, and kudos to you know, Bill Block, who wasn't sure he liked what we were doing at first, but in the end we tested the movie and he ended up being a great ally. He was running Miramax at the time. He gave me Final Cut and Roy Lee and Steven Schneider ushered the movie through production. And it was, and so now we have it. And it's, you know, this, the first movie I've made that's gotten a wide theatrical release. And so what you experienced with me, Winter, at that with me and all those other people who came to the premiere was just, I felt like I was dreaming. It was wow. Really, really a beautiful moment because I'm really proud of the work and it's nice to have something that's connecting with people.
The thing I love about it, if we're talking about it in the context of King, is that I realized, and even thinking about, like, I love Dolores Claiborne. Carrie. Obviously, I read Carrie when I was 9, which is a perfect time to read Carrie. I don't care. I will make my 9-year-old daughter read Carrie. Origin, yeah. Is that I walked out of it. I remember saying to myself as I came home, and I was talking to Alan.
There's a lot of Bush in that movie.
There's a lot.
There's
a lot of Bush in that movie. Is that I realized that not one thing, it was beautiful. It's a beautiful film, JT. I mean, it's beautiful. Like, it's gorgeous to look at.
Oh, thank you.
Is that I've never been afraid of a man. And I've never been in fear. I've never once been like, oh my God, this guy scares me. Oh my God, I'm afraid. And I was like, is that weird? It's true. I don't know.
Very believable, isn't it, Eric?
I don't know if it's because of my dad, who's like my homie and has always been very transparent with me and is, you know, physically a tall, you know, broad-shouldered dude, but like a total softy and the sweetest, stern, but sweet. I don't know if it's because Alan is Alan. I don't know what it is, but I've never been afraid of a man. And I actually think that I've had to soften in order to not be so laugh in your face at a man and make them feel small. I think that's the reason I got married at 38.
We both.
Yeah, you know. So I think that, you know, in watching her, I was like, of course, I was like, a, for sure. My favorite scene is a throwaway. I love throwaway scenes when she throws his badge into the to the wastebasket. I'm like, right. I'm just like, it's just stuff like that I really love, which is very much a part of my id. JT, I felt your id all over it. I did, you know, for the listeners, I've known JT for 20 years, so we've known each other since our 20s, so to be in our 40s and to come to this point, yeah, I felt your id all over it. And I think that, you know, to be able to get to the point where you can kind of see yourself in a film. And I think Stephen King does that in spades, even when he's, you know, even when I was forced, I thought we were talking about the Dark Tower and I had to read the Dark Tower this weekend. I was like, that was
you read the entirety of the Dark Tower this weekend?
I read The Gunslinger.
And, oh, okay. you haven't even really gotten into the good stuff yet.
I know.
You saw the email where we were like, yes, let's talk about Revival, right?
No,
you saw
I was at the old cella with my mom and dad, as I told you. I was at my old cella with my mom and my dad. We were dancing to Charlie Wilson and did not have mobile data. Then my mom and dad were in town, and then I was trying to read stuff and take care of my very chaotic mother. And my dad made me watch 13 episodes of Blue Bloods. And I literally made me. He was very passionate about that. So I was spending quality time with my mom and dad. And
Nice trying to turn this around and make us feel guilty about this. I see what you're doing, but you know what would be fun is as JT and I are talking about Revival, how about that way station scene where Roland punches the jawbone out of a wall?
The slow mutants. You really should just start reading Drawing of the Three right now, and
we can, okay, fine.
It's a great book.
I was planning on drawing comparisons between Mortal Kombat and The Dark Tower because
Mortal
that was,
Kombat.
What?
Yep, I found a through line, but you know what? All good.
Mortal Kombat probably has more to do with Revival, Winter, since he's reading. Yes. You got that secret electricity thing
you
going on.
You have put me in so many crazy scenarios on this show. Why would that be any different?
That's true. And I'm surprising you now. You have a hard out, I know. But we are going to rewatch Dreamcatcher right now with JT on the line.
you had an episode with Thomas Jane.
We did. We've had two episodes with Thomas Jane. Yeah.
He came to our premiere. He's become a buddy over the last He did.
He's been publicly shamed enough that he wears shoes now. Because Wampler brought that up when he came on the show for the first time, which was an incredible episode. JT, you need to go back. You should listen to both of them, but both of his appearances on the show. But you need to go back and listen to that first one because it was one of those things. You know how you when you like logged in here, like we were talking a bit before we started recording. It became very clear that one like just starts off with a bang because we had lost like 3 minutes of gold just in bullshitting. And and Anne Heche, he was dating at the time, and she makes a fucking cameo appearance at the beginning. And and like throughout the episode, you're listening to it, and you hear Anne Heche screaming at somebody over the phone, like in the other room. And people were like, is Tom okay? Is like something, is there like domestic? It's like, nope, it's just that's the relationship there.
Hollywood, baby.
And the whole time he's lighting his fucking pipe and talking about how he started smoking a pipe when he was directing episodes of The Expanse, because that's what directors do, is they smoke pipes.
I gotta listen to that. It's so weird because I became a fan of his way back after watching him play Neil Cassidy in Last Time I Committed Suicide, and I've been hooked on him ever since. I think he's great, and I made offers to him over the years for things, and there were passes because, you know, the money was too low and nobody knew who I was or whatever. And then Christy Hall at the Paradigm Agency because we cast a few, two of our leads in Strange Darling from Paradigm. They liked the movie and they were like, we can show it to Thomas Jane if you'd like. And so we screened it for him at Paradigm privately. And he just really dug it. And we connected. And it's funny, I feel terrible now. Cause I actually, the first time I met him, I did say, I'm surprised you're in shoes. And he kind of, he has a really great sense of humor. Like he's not uptight about anything. So he didn't really laugh at it. He just said, nope. Yeah. I'm definitely wearing shoes. Yeah. And so I'm glad he stayed friends with me after that. Cause I'm sure he's sick of fucking about it.
Look, you don't wear shoes. People are going to ask you when you were wearing shoes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And he always wears shoes since I've seen him. And yeah, we had dinner and he was way less eccentric in person than I think I expected Neil Cassidy or something.
When was this?
I just met him probably 6 months ago and we've hung out a few times since.
Yeah, he might be RFK.
Yeah, I was going to say he might be a little depressed right now because he was a big RFK Jr. guy. Which brought up on his last appearance, and
well, hopefully he's not still an RFK Jr. guy.
He probably is. We don't know.
Tom Jane, you never know, man. You never know what's happening. But I agree with you. He's a wonderful actor. He's a great dude to chat with. He's a great guy. I've smoked cigars with Tom Jane. He's just a great dude to sit and chill and bullshit.
I love talking to him. He's just seems like such a he's such a good dude, and I've had really great conversations with him, and I can't wait to work with him. He's such an underappreciated actor. I mean, I know people appreciate him who appreciate him, but I feel like there should have been, I don't know. I just think he's one of those guys, man. He's like Jason Patrick. I mean, he's just such a fucking amazing actor.
They tie the room together. Yeah. They're like a great rug that ties the room together.
Totally. Yeah.
He's ferocious when he wants to be. And they can also disappear into characters.
Oh, really yeah. Good.
1922, speaking of. Yeah. Anyway, we're not talking about 1922.
Yeah, we're going to get murdered by the listeners if we don't start talking about Revival, but I need your Stephen King origin story to unlock that door. So
I'll do this quickly. Yes. I when I was in second grade, because I remember the teacher. So what age are kids in second grade? I'm so
like six, seven.
Seven.
Yeah.
So I was taken to, I was visiting my aunt in California. I grew up in Las Vegas. I was visiting my aunt in California. She took me up to Ojai for the weekend. It was for like Easter break, like spring break. And there's a great bookstore in Ojai. It's still there. It's an outdoor, half indoor, half outdoor, used and new bookstore. It's amazing. It's fucking like one of my favorite places in the world still. And she took me there when I was a kid. We're walking around and I see a paperback Carrie. Cover of Carrie, and I was obsessed with horror, but my parents wouldn't let me watch rated R movies. My mom never had any limitations on what I could read. So I really wanted to read I'd never read like a novel. And so I'd heard of Stephen King, of course. I was, I guess, 7 years old. And I bought Carrie. It was like a used paperback. My aunt bought it for me. I read it. That ended up being my first novel that I read. I think it took me like a year, like, you know, 8 months or some crazy amount of time. I inched my way through it. There's a lot of stuff I didn't understand. The bleeding at the beginning, I didn't know what was going on. I had to ask my parents about it. It was super awkward, but I was sent, I had the book on my desk.
What are dirty pillows?
And I had the book on my desk in second grade. And that teacher, at my elementary school, sent me to the principal's office because I had it was like adult content. It was like having a porn mag or something.
Yeah.
And I was sent to the principal's office and I it's funny. It's one of those only times, cause I got sent to the principal's office fairly frequently. I wasn't, I usually got along with my teachers, but I wasn't the most, you know, the easiest kid I was getting in trouble a lot. I was talking too much and shit.
Yep.
So
they, same.
Really? No way.
No, not Winter.
No, I just always was making trouble and, you know, not horrible trouble, but I'd get sent up. So I got sent up there, and this was the one time, because I knew how much my mom and my dad supported me being a reader and wanted me to be reading. And I knew this was one thing that no matter how much they were upset at me at school, I wasn't going to get up in trouble for it. So I went to the principal's office. Her name was Dr. Cahoon. She said they were going to call my mother. And when they called my mom and talked to her, she said, "I'm sorry, there's nothing you can do to get me to tell my kid it's not okay to read." Mm-hmm. And so I obviously wasn't allowed to have that book in class anymore.
Right.
But I finished reading it, and that was my gateway to Stephen King. And of course I went back to read it years later, but from that point on, I was like a constant reader, and it was probably too young to be reading Carrie, but I just loved,
I just never.
Well, I mean, King, I've noticed with King, he hooks them young, you know, yep. he's like the neighborhood drug dealer. He gets them young, and then they're his for forever. But I was similar. I was a little bit of a late bloomer compared to you. It was sixth grade for me, and my book was Cujo, but I had the exact same thought process of like, I want to read something adult. I knew Stephen King. And in that case, I'd seen the movie and I knew the movie. And I'm like, this is going to be my way of being able to understand this adult
book. You'd seen the movie. Yeah. I guess it was sixth grade. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, my parents weren't really, they weren't strict with what I watched. There was only like one instance where they were just, I remember my mom going, like, no, this is too much for you. And she like hid the VHS away from me, and she hid it in a place that was super obvious. And I just went and like the second that their back was turned, I went on top of her dresser and fucking, you know, climbed up on top of the dresser like kids do, where they pull out the drawers to make steps. And I just went up and and grabbed the VHS. And you know what it was? It was a combo VHS, you know, where you could record like 6 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
Half of our VHS collection was recorded off of HBO or TV or whatever movies.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a double feature of Aliens and the Fly.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And I don't know why that was, because like I watch Jaws every day in my fucking like childhood. Like I love that movie. I watch R-rated stuff all the time. I don't know why she got it in her head, that one in particular. Like, no, you can't watch Aliens and the Fly. You know,
no David Cronenberg.
She hates Gina Davis.
She's one. Is she on that list? Is she on her on her list?
No, I have no idea.
William H. Macy's on my mom's list. I wasn't allowed to watch things like up until 4, and then they gave up because I was the only one who knew how to control technology in the house. So right. I was responsible for recording everything and hooking up all the cable and stuff. So they couldn't stop me from watching things. So I was able to sort of get in there really early because my parents were big partiers, as evidenced by taking them to Coach Old Cella this weekend. So they would be hungover. So I'd watch everything. And not hungover like addicts. They were hungover like partiers. And I want to be clear. Like hippie parents. But the thing is I'm listening to you guys talk about like JTU not being able, like growing up in Vegas and there being some conservatism in the schools. I grew up was born and raised in San Francisco. They're just... The Stephen King books were in our library.
So jealous. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
When I finally visited San Francisco as I grew older, I was like, oh, this is like a cool.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks Vegas is like this like liberal place. It's like living anyway. I don't want to.
Clark County but Clark County has its own issues. But San Francisco is very liberal. And it wasn't a thing to go into the school library and have we had a whole section of King.
That's fantastic.
And it was, you know, I would check books out religiously, and I would get the librarian be like, Winter, she would stop me in the hall. Do you still have Carrie? Do you still have Christine? Mm. Do you still have Cujo? And I'd be like, yeah. And she's like, bring it back. And I would have it for weeks, months, you know, the entire school semester into the next semester, into the fall, winter, bring it back. So he's ever present. He's ever.
Yeah. I felt like, when I was in school, it was like Ron DeSantis was running, you know, Clark County.
<All right.
laughs> I don't know what the fuck was going on. But they were very uptight. I'm sure things have changed. That was a few years ago.
Things might have changed for the better there. It changed differently for me because my middle school library, I moved to Texas in eighth grade. So it was right when junior high was starting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or seventh grade. So And I remember I had a teacher, and I at this point had already decided I was reading everything Stephen King wrote. And then I had a teacher who was like, he was a social studies teacher that was also a gym teacher, you know, kind of, you know, he's one of those dudes. And in my memory,
exactly the dude.
In my memory, he looked a lot like Kim Coates, you know, okay. The actor.
Yeah.
He probably didn't look like this in real life. It's been a long time. But I remember he noticed I was reading Stephen King stuff, and he was like, oh, have you ever read The Dark Tower? And I said, no. He's like, oh, you should read The Dark Tower. And guess what? My fucking middle school library had Gunslinger, Drawing of the Three, and Wastelands in their library. They had like a Stephen King shelf in like, wow. We're talking seventh and eighth grade. Now cut to last year, my girlfriend, who's a teacher, got a job at my old middle school. And I'm like, oh, this is great. Aww. And I went and helped her set up her classroom. And then that's, I'm like, sweet. I have to go into the library to see if it still has this stuff, and fucking nothing.
Nothing
above a white novel in there anymore. Yeah. But it was a pretty wonderful moment in time. But
what part of Texas was that?
Austin. This is Austin.
Yeah, so I know you're there now, but you were in Austin. Wow, now there's no? That's weird.
Mm-mm. No, yeah. I mean, I don't know if the whole school district is I don't know. Things are a mess right now. Like, the kids are wilding out, and, you know, things are getting crazy. Everybody's violent and addicted to their technology. I don't envy teachers these days.
It was very, very good to us. I mean, that's where we premiered at Fantastic Fest.
I know. And I missed the screening there, but I did see it, see the movie finally this weekend. So it ultimately benefited you, really, because I didn't watch, you know, I actually contributed to the box office. So me and
to go to the movies and see it.
We went to the AMC.
Oh, thank you.
Got the recliner seats and our popcorn and our Coke Zero and sat there and watched your movie and fucking loved it. You know, we should probably talk a little bit about Mr. Reverend Charles Jacobs here. I'm looking at the clock, and I'm like, we have about 20 more minutes to talk, and we haven't talked about the topic at hand. And I think that it's mostly winter trying to steer us away from this conversation, since
because she read
we were reading The Gunslinger.
No, don't put that on me. Don't put that voodoo on you, Winter. Don't put that voodoo on me. You know I am breezy. When I say I'm breezy, I'm breezy, Vespi. I'm breezy.
We're very breezy. It's a breeze. I did like preface this before we started recording, saying, hey, we love going down blind alleyways here. So,
and we've gone down.
And now we've done it to the point where we haven't brought up the goddamn title.
I am three blind mice. Fun
to talk to you guys for a few hours. I mean, I don't know if anybody else thinks it's fun, but like, I would enjoy this for longer.
No, this is fun.
It's been a blast. And we can still keep this reverence up. Let's just put Revival in the background somewhere, you know?
Okay.
But wait, you said Cujo was your gateway into Stephen King. And before we go on to Revival, I can't be on this show without saying that in the movie, which Louis Teague film, amazing movie, Dee Wallace's performance is like an Oscar worthy.
Yeah.
It's one of the greatest performances in cinema has.
100%. It's without question. It's one of those where I think when Scott and I started the show, we were like, you know what, you know, Cujo, yeah, it was a movie we liked as kids. You know, it probably doesn't hold up. It's probably a goofy 80s movie. And then we went back to it. We're like, this movie fucking rips.
So well, it's like,
she is so incredibly great as Donna Trenton. She sells the horror of everything. Jan de Bont's cinematography is incredible. Mm-hmm. The way they move the camera and the inventiveness of making that teeny tiny Pinto that you're stuck in, like cinematic. It's like, it's kind of a miracle of a movie. It's an undersung miracle.
The heat, how hot and miserable it is.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. It's really well made. It holds up, I think. And have you guys had D on here?
Yep. Had D. Yep. She came in to talk about that, and then we right before Scott passed, we were about to launch a new show called The Spiel, which is what we do for Stephen King with the KingCast. We do for Steven Spielberg with The Spiel. And she came on in one of the episodes that Scott and I recorded before he died was with Dee talking about E.T. So she is just a lovely, wonderful person. You have to know when you're talking to Dee that you give her about 5 minutes to talk about her healing and crystal stuff, and then then she can get back on on topic. But she's very David wonderful.
Lynch with TM, which by the way, but with Dee. She's so good, and she was the star of one of my short films. I've been trying to find a way to work with her again, but I'll tell you, I've called her sometimes in moments of crisis, and she's like, or she'll call me randomly in a moment of crisis where everything, she's like, you need to talk to me right now.
Oh,
I'll be like, I need to talk to you right now. What the fuck? And I'm like, I'm one of those skeptics. So, but with her, she always seems to know when we need to talk. So I think, the work she's doing, there's something to it. There's really something to it.
She's calling Winter right now to be like, I know you're freaking out. You didn't do the homework on this one.
Yeah.
I'm not a skeptic. I believe that everything happens for a reason, and kudos to Dee Wallace Stone for on her crystal work.
Yeah.
Did you guys set your intentions for the new moon?
Her work is real. Her work is real.
Probably not.
If I could stick to it more often, I would be much more balanced.
Did you set your intentions for the new moon? No, you didn't. So you're not doing your work.
Just like, I just read the wrong. Yeah. Of course I did. Okay. Yes, Dee, if you're listening, I did it. I did it.
Right.
Like Scott's gone like 3 months, and suddenly we turn into one of these crystal fucking podcasts. Not suddenly,
baby. I'm from San Francisco, sweetheart. I've been on that train for
decades. I was born in the Bay Area. Come on now.
Okay. Revival.
I do believe.
The revival.
I do believe in secret electricity.
Okay. Yes,
something I believe in.
The revival,
much like Dee Wallace Stone and her crystals and her meditation books.
Yeah, we can segue this way.
We can segue much like that. There's a revival.
Revival.
Yes. Revival. So yes, there is a revival and revival. Good job, Winter. Wonderful setup. Winter, do you want to describe the plot? No, I'm just fucking with you.
There's some heroin in revival too.
There is. There's some heroin. Yes, it's mid-roll time, and as I said at the top of this episode, this is a complete buyout, baby! So I will be telling you a little bit more about The Devil by Name from Keith Rawson. The Devil by Name is the follow-up to Rawson's smash hit, The Fever House. It's a heart-stopping saga set against the ravaged landscape of a post-apocalyptic America, one in which survivors are united by the desire to not just escape death, but to carve out some way to live anew. The Devil by Name is what Publishers Weekly calls literary horror at its finest. Devil by Name is available from Random House and can be found wherever books are sold. I've already mentioned, you don't need to take my word for it, or even Publishers Weekly for it. Take Stephen King's words for it. He says, once again, exciting, suspenseful, and horrifying. And you know Stephen King knows what those words mean. He wouldn't just slap that on any old book. No, he only saves that kind of praise for the real good shit. So, you know Keith Rawson's The Devil by Name is that good shit. And you also know that Stephen King loves a good post-apocalyptic Americana story. So if he's saying this is good and this is the guy that wrote The Stand, you got to listen to Uncle Stevie here. So once again, The Devil by Name, out by Random House. Now you can find it wherever books are sold. Now let's get back to the show. Basically, I mean, I'd assume that most people listening to this, we've done a couple episodes on this. This is Revival's a title that we champion every chance we get. It's one of those where I remember when I read it, this was kind of King getting his groove back post accident. He did a few iffy books. He did, some good books, but just okay. And then he hit 11/22/63 in the late aughts. And then he just did all these bangers after that. And, he did Joyland. He did, his recent stuff has all been great too. But in amongst that stuff was Revival, which still to this day, even with all the championing that the show has done, and I can almost guarantee you, just based on our social media and people who have picked up the book because of us, you know, we bought Stephen King a cup of coffee at this point, recommending this book. But it is just, it's not only like plays to all of his strengths of character work, it has one of his best endings ever. And for my money, I think Revival next to maybe Pet Sematary is like the scariest thing that he's written. And now the thing with Revival is it's not like Pet Sematary is creepy from get go. And you know, and it only gets like worse and worse and bleaker and bleaker. Revival, on the other hand, starts kind of, it takes a while for the horror to set in. And it's more of a sucker punch where the horror really takes place at the end. And it takes you a minute to get there. And the horror up till that point is more real life horror, tragedy of losing someone you love, you know, addiction, kind of flailing, not knowing where your place is in the world, obsession, you know, that kind of stuff. But it's not until the end where he goes, you know what? Fuck yeah, I'm the master of horror. And just real quick, it's all about a preacher named Charlie Jacobs, who is just a lovely family guy when you first meet him, and you meet him when he's real young, and our main character is a child. Something very bad happens to this guy's family. He kind of disappears, shows up a little bit later doing like carnival
magic. I love that section of the book. It's so good.
And that's where, you know, basically the structure of this is you're having this young character, Jamie Morton, who met him as when he was a kid, who then runs into him, you know, when he's strung out on heroin in his 20s, and then he meets him again, you know, later. And every time he sees Reverend Jacobs, he's becoming more and more obsessed with electricity and trying to pierce the veil and see what's on the other side. And you know, he has a good reason for it, because his family is killed early on in the story. And he, you know, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful character, because it's a guy who's doing evil things and experimenting on people.
So sympathetic.
But yeah, you know why he's doing it. So yeah. So that's the basics of the plot. I won't make you guys run through it. But Winter, have you read this at all, or do you just
reputation? Let's get right into it.
I have not, but it's the themes, obviously, I can relate to, and I love it. It sounds fantastic, obviously.
Well, I do appreciate, I mean.
Now I don't want to spoil it.
So yes. Don't spoil it. I'm not one of those weird people like that. Go for it. Get into it, JT.
Are we supposed to not spoil it? No, because there's probably people like we can talk about the ending without getting super specific.
Yeah, I think it's probably best, especially since we only have like 10 more minutes anyway.
Go.
This episode maybe got away from us a little bit. I didn't get much sleep last night. JT's got a cold. And winter is winter.
You've got 15 minutes. Just keep going. I'm going to make it. Don't worry about me. Do what is right. Do what is right. Feel it.
It's a really good. I agree with you, Eric, on the fact that when this book came out, and the strangest thing to me is it doesn't feel like it was, because time goes fucking so fast now in life. It's just the weird. It doesn't feel like it was 10 years ago when this book came out. It just blows my mind, because I think of it as like one of his late period books, like his most more recent period. And I guess it is. It's kind of the beginning of it. But when I picked this book up, and I have this thing about Stephen King. Wherever there's really nothing, I think there's only been one book of his that I like didn't really want to finish. I wasn't really connecting with everything else. Almost everything I've ever read by Stephen King is such comfort food for me, because he's such an amazing, he draws these characters in such a way, and he creates this world in such a way that some people won't understand this, but I actually feel comforted. It's not always horror I'm looking for when I'm reading Stephen King. I actually like to be in the King, Stephen King country. I like to be there and love how he, and there's these horrific things that happen, but there's all these real human connections and emotions and everything, even when it's at its most bizarre, feels grounded in his books and realistic, and the characters feel so real. And he goes off on these, you know, there'll be backstory. I mean, he does it for a whole book in the Dark Tower series, Wizard of Oz. And there'll be backstory that really doesn't need to be there to drive the story forward, but it doesn't matter. It makes everything so much more rich. And so that's what I love experiencing every Stephen King book, but some are good and some are great. And the good ones for me, usually what separates the good from the great for me are his endings.
Mm.
And I think once in a while, I just feel let down by the ending, but I don't care. Because it was such a great experience going through the book. And I think there are certain examples with The Mist, for instance. I do think Frank Darabont improved on the ending.
Yes, right? For sure.
And I think Stephen King agrees with that too, which is amazing. And so so I love it when he doesn't always stick the ending, but when he does stick the landing on an ending, it's fucking good. And so that's why I love the Dark Tower series so much, because the ending is so, and I come from the school of, you know, Flannery O'Connor, Rod Serling. And I like apocalyptic, dark, ironic endings, you know?
Yep.
So when he goes there and he goes there hard, it really works. And this book, the place it goes, and you know, it's got such a sweet opening. And I do think that Charlie's character is so likable. And there's never a moment I keep hoping throughout the entire book that Jamie is going to find the mentor and the warm person that he knew. And I keep hoping he's going to find the Charlie that he met in the beginning of the book. And we're going to get Charlie to become who we hoped he could be. But it obviously never really happens. He keeps descending and descending and descending into this obsession. But the ending of this book, the last act gets really dark. And the ending actually reminds me a lot of the ending of the Dark Tower, because it says so much and you don't even want to really face what it says.
Mm.
You know? And so it stuck with me. And I remember finishing it and I was so shook by where it goes and the message, which I don't think there's a message. I think it's a work of fiction. It's meant to stimulate us. And it's what happens in this book. I think too many people look for message in it when sometimes it's just about, you know, making you feel a certain way. It's very nihilistic sort of ending, and the world that they see when they pull the curtain back and see nothing essentially. A lot of it reminded me of the original Phantasm, actually. Mm. A lot of that there.
Right.
And so I just love a book gutting me like this book did. And I cared so much for the characters. And I wanted them to be okay. And nobody really is.
No.
At the end of this book. So it stuck with me. And I remember finishing reading it. And I'd only made a few short films at the time. And I called like my manager and I was like, I want to turn this into a movie. And of course there was no way that was going to happen.
Right.
But I keep hearing that people are going to make this into a movie. I keep hoping that at some point, you know, Roy Lee will call me and say, it went through all the proper hands and now I've got it. Do you want to make this? Because it could be so cinematic. It's just a beautiful book.
It could be. You'll have a death mark on you from Mike Flanagan, who tried to make it. I read his script for it. He sent the script, and it's fucking great.
Wait, was Mike one of the guys who was the guy who was supposed to make this?
He was. He wrote a script, and essentially, I think it was Warner's. This is going to be right after Dr. Sleep, maybe.
Yeah.
And so Dr. Sleep tanked, and then Warner said, absolutely fucking not with that ending. You were not making this movie. And he's like, well, I'm not making the movie without that ending. So
Dr. Sleep tank? It's so well regarded. Everybody
loved it. It was. Yeah, it was a huge flop. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, he probably could do it now. I don't know. I know Mike. I met him through Willa Fitzgerald, who is the star of our film, who was on House of Usher.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant filmmaker.
She's great.
He's the other Darabont to me. Like, he's the only other guy who's really gotten it right many times.
Yeah.
Stephen King adaptations.
Yeah.
I, if I, yeah, I had no idea he was. He gave us a quote for Strange Darling. He's been a big, big supporter of the film. It's been in all the
advertising. He's legitimately one of the nicest dudes. And Life of Chuck Great fucking guy. Rules, too. So he's his streak of kicking ass with Stephen King adaptations continues. And I think he's now officially made more than he's matched Darabont. He's made more than Rob Reiner, because Rob Reiner did Stand By Me and Misery.
Well, those are two pretty damn good movies. Yeah, I forget there are some others who have gotten it right.
Yeah,
but he's done really good by Stephen King, and also his own stuff. I mean, the House of Usher is so good, and he's really great. I didn't know he was going to do this. I had no idea.
Yeah, well, what's crazy is if you've seen his Intrepid logo, it looks like it's from Revival, because it's like this dude, he kind of looks like a skinny preacher, he's wearing that kind of black clothes, and he's like raising his arms up and lightning is crossing the sky, and I'm just like, I wonder if he if that played into the logo. I've never asked Mike that. I'm sure it did in the back of his mind somewhere, because he's such a Stephen King nerd. But
I'm going to ask him if he's too busy with his other Stephen King projects and he just wants to find a way to get this done and let me play around with it.
Yeah, I don't think he has the rights anymore. So you might be able to hit up Rand.
Somebody's got to make it. Someone's got to make it. Even if it doesn't have to be me. I just want somebody to make it. If Mike was making it, I'd be really excited, because I want this movie to be. It's just a really cinematic book.
And once again, the script was fucking great, and it expanded and focused on things that you wouldn't necessarily think of. He came up with there's some imagery in the script that I wonder if he repurposed a little bit for Midnight Mass. Again, I'd have to ask him this stuff, and maybe all that's just coincidence, and it's just some Flanaganisms that made its way in there. But if you got that call from Roy Lee tomorrow, he says, I have this, we want to make it. Tell me who you want to cast now. And if they say yes, who would you, then we have a movie. Who would you go to for Jacobs? Would this be somebody that you cast different actors for the different time periods? Would you do makeup, de-aging? Would you fuck that structure completely? And like, what would be your thought?
You know, it's weird with Jacobs. It would, to me, not thinking about age at all and or how we would do the age, it feels like Billy Crudup.
Wow. Okay.
Like, everybody has a different feeling about these characters, but there's something, like, I feel like the guy, it has to be cast, for him at least, with somebody who's seems earnest and kind and not creepy, but also has some sort of edge. And, like, isn't too obvious. And right. This is the first time I've even thought about casting. Yeah. That's the first name that came to mind, but, just that sort of type. And, I don't know.
I guess the question is, do you, for this character, like, do you lean into who sells the finale the best, or who sells the opening and the descent the best? Or do you have to make the choice? You know, because if you're looking at it just, like, when I think of Jacobs, I flash on like Michael Shannon, but I flash on Michael Shannon for the later half of from the huckster carnival barker version up through the obsessed, millionaire, in the castle playing with secret electricity, mad scientist version.
Like, that's the great
thing. But I don't see him so much at the beginning version of Jacobs.
That's the great thing about books. It's like we talk right now and maybe we'll have very different ideas. I mean, Michael Shannon's incredible. He'd be great in this role too. He's good in everything he does. But for me, I've never been able to let go reading this book. And part of what I think we talked about a bit earlier is that with Jacobs, I see him as this really good, fresh. There's a way I see him that I can't shake. Even later in the book, when he's, lying about, or he's using the electricity, but saying he's a religious, he's able to do God's doing this stuff, and he's kind of a huckster. I feel like I never can let go in the book of thinking that underneath it all, he's justifying it, and he's like a good person. We can bring that good person back. And so I think for me, I'd like to cast it with how he's perceived by Jamie at the beginning.
Right.
And then find a way to, morph him into this evil character. And I think that that's what makes him so compelling to me, because he's such a likable character in the beginning. He's such a optimistic character. And then he becomes this other thing. And I feel like somebody, a great actor like Michael Shannon or Sean Penn, mm-hmm. or, you know, the people I would kill to work with, or even like a Joaquin Phoenix or something yeah. like that. These actors, I feel like it's got to be somebody who seems more optimistic at the very beginning, and we turn them into that sort of actor, you know?
Well, Joaquin wouldn't show up 3 days before filming. So
yeah.
No, but I could see him fucking up doing that. Yeah. Danny McBride it is.
I have a follow up. What is the connection to Mortal Kombat?
You tell us.
Pardon the pun, but the undercurrent of the story is all about the secret electricity.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. so I thought Raiden electricity.
There you go.
I was making the joke. But there's also, you know, there's lots of portals and shit in Mortal Kombat, and there's at a certain point you peer past the veil, and instead of seeing a bunch of buff dudes with superpowers beating the shit out of each other and ripping spinal cords out, you see something that's even more horrifying and awaits us all, and there's nothing that you can do about it, which leads to this whole existential horror that this story leaves you with, which to this day is the worst. Like, this doesn't hold a candle to The Stand. The Stand doesn't hold a candle to this. The Stand wipes out almost every human on Earth, and it's still somehow less of a bleak bummer of an ending than this is. Because at least there you can say, hey, God and the devil exist, and a lot of people ended up in heaven in that one. And this one,
You knew I could tie it together.
You did it. Of course.
Have you read Providence, Winter? Caroline Kepner's book.
Not yet. Mm-mm.
Caroline Kepner. It's that's another book I've been trying to get a hold of for a long time, and Caroline and I have been trying to make that happen. But it's kind of a sister story to this in many ways, or I think a lot of ways inspired by this, but this book was very much inspired by, you know, the great God Pan and Frankenstein. Yeah. And so it's derivative, but it does its own thing in such a beautiful and interesting way. And there's especially that whole section in the, you know, the circus, the carnival section where he's doing all that. It's like its own, it turns into a different book, and it's like we're going into a whole nother genre.
It's a little episodic. Yeah. There's like three acts really in three different parts of this person's life, which in an interesting way kind of mirrors the life of Chuck as well, which is, you know, three different acts that take place in different points, except it's just told in reverse, that story. So it's definitely, I don't know, this one's full blown Stephen King for me. It's like the characters just fucking jump off of the page. You're so into it when Jacobs has his the bad sermon that he does after his family, you know, is killed in a car accident.
Mm.
You know, he has this moment where he just goes, you know, I can't believe in God, because if God does exist, then he's a motherfucker, and I can't have that. And I'm telling you all, this is a sham. We've all been duped. Life sucks.
And after his family dies, isn't there a whole, like, I feel like there's an entire, he like breaks down in front of the whole town. Like there's a big speech he gives or a certain.
Yeah. That's the bad sermon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then he's essentially, of course, this small town goes, nah, blasphemer, get the fuck out of here. So pretty much it's just the kid that you know, that he, you know, kind of formed this bond with. That still likes him. And, you know, but and there's
I'm fascinated by, sorry, Vespi, keep going.
No, you go, please. No, I was just trailing off anyway.
No. I'm fascinated by post-traumatic injury King. In life and in his work,
right?
You know, because he's had all of these personal sort of struggles that I think we know more about him. It's almost poetic, because most of these big mass creators of work that you hear about, you're not really waiting, hanging on James Patterson's,
you know, personal, you know, right. like what's going on in his day to day. I don't really give a shit about what's going on with Colleen Hoover's day to day at all. I also don't read her shit at all. But, you know, I don't. But I'm saying, like, Steven, you're just like, there's a commitment to understanding him as a person for some reason, with what little we know about him. But the post-traumatic injury era seems to have, just from being on the show and like listening to you and Wampler talk about him, you guys really romanticize it in a very, I love it when you guys talk about it, because mm-hmm. it's, you seem to gravitate a little bit more to that material, I think. Mm. I don't know.
Yeah. Kind of. It's yeah. almost like that bad sermon that Eric's talking about. It could have been like, that almost could have been how Stephen King handled certain things in his
yeah.
life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like he could have gone down, he sees maybe the dark path he could have taken if he just
right.
gave up on everything. He was like, fuck everything. He's gone through so much, you know, I mean, On Writing's one of the great books and,
yeah.
and it's like the that memoir, and I usually don't care much about artists' personal lives at all, but his has so much to do with, he said so much to do with his trajectory of, and how the work is in certain, how it's reflected, reflects his life in certain points in his life. And, you know, there was the overcoming addiction and all that. And then there's that this traumatic accident. But I think that, you know, there's two camps, and you guys are the Stephen King experts. So, cause you actually do a show about his work, but there's two camps that I've noticed sort of, in my life when I talk to other Stephen King fans, and it's like, there are a few people who want in the last couple decades, they miss him doing more straightforward, high concept horror, like, like, oh, Carrie. Okay. It's very, you can describe that in one line. Cujo, Rabid Dog, great books. Some of my favorites.
Christine, Evil Car.
Christine, yeah. Exactly. They're high concept horror. And I actually feel very different. This last 10, 15 years of his work is so interesting to me, and I love it all for different reasons, but you know, I love The Institute, and I love Billy Summers, and I love, I'm really digging You Like It Darker so far, and I think that there's something so human about, and you know, even though the book we're talking about today is so terrifying, and it has such a, you know, horrific conclusion, Revival is not as straight up. It's not a one genre book. It really isn't. And that's what I love about it. And it's what I'm drawn to in my work as well. Which is why some people can't figure out sort of what the genre is of this movie I just made. But I love that he has romance and friendship and you know, relationships and addiction.
That's life.
Life. I think it was David Lynch who said life doesn't happen in a genre, which is why there's, it's not all.
He also said, it's Tuesday.
He did. That's my favorite quote of his, actually.
It's true.
You haven't finished You Like It Darker yet.
No, I almost wanted to talk about Bad Dream.
Danny Coughlin's Bad Dream, yeah.
Yeah, Danny Coughlin's Bad Dream, because I just read that, and that was fresh in my mind.
Have a story coming up, and this is one of the last King things that Scott ever read, by the way, because he skipped right to the story when the book came out, and the book came out like 10 days before he died. Mm-hmm. And he skipped to the story called The Dreamers, which is the second to last story in the collection. And he skipped to it because the word on the street was, hey, this is some revival ass shit going on here. Mm. And it is absolutely. The Dreamers is like what Little Sisters of Illuria is to, you know, the Dark Tower. This story is to Revival.
I like that one a lot.
It's not as directly connected, but it's like, oh, okay, you're playing in the same sandbox and finding the same terrible, horrible answers to some of these experiments. So I highly recommend you, you know, I maybe don't skip to it. There's a lot of really good stuff in that collection, but definitely keep an eye out.
Please read them in order, and I'll read them. It should have happened so much quicker. I've had a weird few months, and I've been really busy, and I'm not reading as fast as normal. But I can't wait to read the rest.
You know, you're releasing a movie and adapting one of the best fucking Stephen King books of ever, and hanging out with all those people. So we'll give you a pass on this one.
Thanks.
But Winter, I know you need to run off, so I could talk Revival for another hour.
I don't want to leave this conversation.
Why don't we just talk about? Wait, let's just talk about the Gunslinger for a little bit before you go.
Okay. Okay. So I'm obsessed.
What did you think of the gun barrel abortion?
here's what look. This is the woman who's like the what's her name? I already forgot it.
Allie?
No. Fuck her. No, the woman who comes in and talks about the interloper. The one who
Sylvia Pittston.
Oh yeah, my the god!
The gun barrel abortion. Yes.
Yes. I am obsessed with her. I'm simply obsessed with her, and I just like look. I have ADD.
I mean, I know you have to go with her. I was just fucking around. You know, we don't really.
Oh, okay. Because I have ADD. So I watched 13 hours of Blue Bloods and also read this. So I'm simply and had to watch the movie. All I'm saying is I'm obsessed with her. I thought that this was one of the things that I really had to compel myself to understand is like I'm not like really into Westerns. It's just not
right.
I'm obsessed with. So I was really I kept trying to define words, and this is what I love about Stephen King more than anything is that I had to immerse myself into a world that I wasn't familiar with for him. And yeah. I was so impressed by how it was seamless for him. Seamless.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I like how he's inspired by things that he clearly grew up on. I mean, considering his age, Westerns, greasers, you know how I can't stand the greasers.
Yeah, right.
I'm so over greasers at a certain point. But Sylvia just took my breath away. Yeah. Sylvia just
took fire and brimstone preachers that
yeah. And I really was tired of them eating corn. So was also every time that they were like a meal of corn, I was like, Here we go,
Stephen King. You and your corn bullshit again. Yeah.
You know, part two is much less of a Western, though. You might like it a little more.
Yeah, well,
Yeah,
the first one is very much like him playing in that Sergio Leone.
Yes, like so much. Box.
And then two, one of the great things, if you continue on the path to the Dark Tower, Winter, is that every
you follow book, the beam.
Every that was book one of seven.
Oh, Winter, okay.
Tower. Oh, yeah.
If you do decide to continue the journey, and Scott would have probably told you to start with Drawing of the Three. Yes. Again, he was fucking wrong about it, and I get to be right on that because I'm the last man standing.
Oh,
and I
boy. Will. Wow, Vespi.
But I still think that, you know, for the entire story to work, you need to start at the beginning of Gunslinger and end at the end of the Dark Tower. That's the only way that story seamlessly works. So
I accept your challenge. I accept
it. But the second book, the reason why Scott would advise people to read the second one first is it's a fucking blockbuster. It's more amazing. Of a sci-fi story. It's like a time travel, time jumpy thing. It's crazy. It
hooks you completely too, and introduces all the characters. There's a
clock. One of the characters is dying throughout the entire. The main character is dying throughout the entire fucking book, and he needs medicine. And like, will he get it? How will he?
The sci-fi tinges in the beginning. I got it there. It definitely felt like they were playing with time.
Really high tension. Like I see why Scott would say that, because like the first book is kind of the setup of this main central character, and it's appropriate that it starts that way because there's an ending that relates to that. But the first book is like appropriate. It's well done. It's a good book. But the second book is the book that hooks people, I think.
Yeah.
You agree with that?
Yeah. Eric? If you finish reading Drawing of the Three, which is the second book, and you go, I don't care about reading the next one right away, it's not for you.
No, like, I'm going to take a challenge. The challenge.
By the time you finish Drawing of the Three, you know, dollars to donuts, you're going to be like, I need to start the beginning of the Wastelands right now.
So addictive.
When you finish the Wastelands, specifically with the Wastelands, there's a cliffhanger ending to that book. you are like, I need to know what the fuck happened right now. And me, when I started reading Dark Tower, those were the only three books out.
Yeah.
So I had to wait 6 years between reading Wastelands and reading the follow-up. So.
No, because I have an aversion to series. And it's because I was committed to Babysitter's Club as a child. And and now I need to recommit to a series. And I've skipped series. So I need to.
Well, now you're committed. You know,
Lion, do it for the Scott. Witch in the Wardrobe. I did it for school. And that was very violent. I did not want to do that. And they made us do it. And I was like, I don't like it. So now I'm going to do this.
Fourth grade for me or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to do it now.
Enough Jesus lions. Where's all the murder?
And what is the fucking wardrobe about? No, I'm going to commit to this. I'm in. I'm in it to win it, my friend.
I'm telling you, Winter, and I know, you know, I got a little bonus being able to talk a little bit about the Dark Tower, but that series for me, and I was an English major, I've you know, read so much different writers. That series to me as a whole, the seven books as one book, was the most impactful reading experience of my life, to the point where I read the seven books and I was so like, I was so just drained and so connected to the characters. I felt like I'd gone through it with them, that once I finished reading that seventh book, I'm usually constantly reading a book. I think it was like a year before I read another fiction novel, because I couldn't go into any other world. I was just like, okay, I'm just going to read, you know, nonfiction and the New Yorker and fucking that's it.
But I believe it. Look at its impact. Look at the impact.
It's so beautiful. If you can get through the whole thing, it's really, really, it's just a special.
So much content every single day and watch. And it's so intense for me. And I've realized that I haven't had a book take me to a faraway place like that in a really long time.
Right.
And it's only through being on the show and having to commit to the show that I am allowed to do that in a way that I enjoy. And so the challenge is accepted. I am accepting the challenge. You got it.
You're going to love these characters so much. It's like there's a few characters that end up together. I almost called my production company Quartet, but I didn't want to fuck around with Stephen King IP stuff.
Yeah, I always wonder how that works, because you have, like, you know, Bad Hat Harry Productions. You got, like, you know, I don't know.
Band Apart. I mean, you do have a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess at some point nobody fucking cares. But I do appreciate you both coming on, and I apologize, Winter, for the confusion on the title that we were talking about, but you rolled with it like a champ, just as I knew you could.
Always, buddy. Always. Anything for you. And JT, thank you for doing this. You're the best. I appreciate it.
Thank you both. It's a great time. I appreciate you having me on.
Many thanks to JT Molnar and Winter Mitchell for coming on the show. That was one of the more chaotic episodes we've done in recent memory. But that's okay. That's actually kind of the vibe that we love to foster here. So I have to give a lot of thanks to JT for rolling with the chaos, and for Winter, of course, for bringing that chaos. She's always dependable. I think I did call her a chaos agent in her intro, and she lived up to it. Love that, Winter Mitchell. I don't love JT yet, just because we've only just met. It would be weird if I said I loved him. So right now, I can say I like JT a lot, and we're going to have to hang out a couple more times and see if that relationship deepens. You know what I mean? You can't just throw out that L word, or else it loses meaning. So, JT, appreciate you coming on the show. Can't wait to see how you went about adapting one of my favorite King stories with The Long Walk. And thanks for being so open and talking about it with us here on the show. You also might have noticed that maybe the deep dive into Revival wasn't what you got this episode. That happens sometimes whenever chaos becomes the predominant flavor. But I will suggest, if you wanted a little bit more in-depth chat about that particular book, I would highly recommend checking out our Revival episode with David Lowry. So we have a little bit of that. I think JT and I, we probably going to spend another hour just bullshitting about Revival stuff, but we were under a little bit of a time crunch. So Speaking of being under a time crunch, I'm going to keep the rest of this outro short and sweet. We'll have a new episode next week as usual. And this upcoming Friday on the Patreon, I have a little treat for you. It's going to be a rare non-Stephen King topic. It didn't feel quite right to let the new Alien movie come and go without discussing it in some way, especially given how much Scott loved that series and how he was chomping at the bit to see this new one. So what I decided to do was I wanted to have an excuse to talk about my own feelings about Alien Romulus. I have some hot takes on it, including how some people maybe overreacted to that one thing that's a little too spoilery to still talk about. But I wanted to reach out to one of Scott's friends who was super into the Alien stuff with him. And that would be Miss Becca Supp, AKA Valhalla Batgirl on Twitter. Like I said, she was very close with Scott and was kind of his alien buddy. They were the ones that would talk alien movies, you know, talk about their ridiculous love of Prometheus and all that fun stuff. So nobody knew how Scott liked his alien stuff better than Becca, I think. That's what they bonded over, and kind of using that as a jumping off point to take a look at this new movie. I'm curious as to what her thoughts on it, curious as to what she thinks Scott would have thought about it, all that stuff. So we're going to be talking about Alien Romulus. It'll be a very spoilery chat, I'm sure. So make sure you see the movie. It's been out for damn near, what, 3-4 weeks now. So you've had your chance to do it. We're going to talk some spoilers. Going to be a fun chat. To hear that, all you got to do is head on over to patreon.com/thekingcast and sign up. You'll get access to that this Friday, and we have bonus episodes every single Friday. So if you're only listening to the main feed, you're only getting half the show. Throw us a few bucks, get a little bit more, and we have over 4 years now of material over there. So patreon.com/thekingcast, sign up. Also, head on over to whatever podcatcher you listen to, and if you're not already, subscribe to the spiel, listen to the new show. We still have some more Wampler-centric episodes there. Still in the can, ready to go, and the show's fucking rules, so I think you're gonna like it. If you like the KingCast, you'll like the spiel. It is to Steven Spielberg what the KingCast is to Stephen King. So I think that's about it for this week. Adios, folks. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly. Yeah.